It is Tuesday, May the 3rd, 8:30. We are here to open a public hearing on House Bill 5067, the Secretary of State, and would invite up Mr. Secretary and whoever else of your group are going to be presenters this morning. This is the Phase 2 presentation to go over the budget details.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, I'm looking forward to phase two of our budget process with this subcommittee. I want to proceed by having each of the division directors present to you a brief overview of their budget and their priorities, and then specifically address the questions that were raised in phase one of our presentation that you all had questions that we will certainly seek to answer. And in addition, there was a request from the committee to look for savings in our internal support divisions, and you'll be hearing from two of our support division directors about opportunities for savings that we have identified. So with that, the first division director to present to you will be our state auditor, Kathy Polino.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audits Division. I thought what I'd do this morning is one of the requests we had was to provide a summary of our legal opinions over the last 50 years. We have that for you. It was a handout that was there. I believe everybody got a copy of it. Okay. So, Madam Chair, what I thought I'd do is go over the legal opinion to start with. I also provided a real brief one-page overview of our performance measures. I wasn't planning on spending a lot of time on it, but that way you can see how the performance measures all tie to the different programs we have in our office. And then what I thought I'd do is just go through your priority list and hit each of the audit ones as they pop up and give you a brief description of the functional area and answer any questions you might have at the point. If that's okay.
I think that sounds fine. Any comments from the PIM? Proceed ahead.
All right. So let's go ahead and start with the letter we got summarizing that it was about the last 50 years of Attorney General opinions about our audit authority.
This is the letter over Mr. Shepard's signature.
That's correct. And if you'll turn to page 2, that big first paragraph basically gives you what is said in the Constitution about our audit authority, and that's in Article 6, Section 2. It says that the Secretary of State shall be, by virtue of his office, auditor of public accounts. That's it. That's about all it says. It doesn't give a real in-depth description of what that means and you know, what sort of duties were given to that. A piece of this is that because it is in the Constitution, it does say that it is self-executing. It doesn't require enabling legislation in order to give it force. And reading the last couple sentences of that first paragraph, neither the Legislative Assembly nor any entity subject to the Secretary of State's audit authority may act in a manner which will compromise the Secretary's constitutional duty to count for public funds and property received and expended. In other words, the legislature may neither limit the scope of the Secretary's audit authority nor delegate any aspect of that authority to any other agency or branch of state government. Now, let's go back to that part about auditor of public accounts and what that really means. At the time the Constitution was written, there actually was an auditor of public accounts, the auditor for the territory. And so if you'll turn to that top of the second page, the way that the Attorney General's opinions have gone over the last 50 years was saying, well, when the framers of the Constitution were writing this Constitution, they think it's in that second paragraph that the knowledgeable drafters of the Constitution were familiar with that Office of Auditor of Public Accounts. And so what they've been doing is looking back at what were the duties of that territorial auditor of public accounts that were in place at the time that the Constitution was written. And actually, the Oregon territorial statutes have a lot more description about what those duties and functions are. And you'll see down, It says that the auditor of public accounts is declared to be the general accountant of the territory and the keeper of all public accounts, books, vouchers, documents, and all papers relating to the accounts and contracts of the territory and its revenue, debt, and fiscal affairs. And you'll see that very last paragraph, it also talks about that the responsibilities are to include reports to the legislature, such recommendations as the secretary deems expedient for the support of public credit, for lessening public expenses, for using public money to the best advantage, for promoting frugality and economy in public offices, and generally for the better management and more perfect understanding of the fiscal affairs of the state. And so that lessening public expenses, using public money to the best advantage, promoting frugality and economy in public office, that is really the charge that we've been given, and it all ties to this concept of fiscal accountability. And that's where, as we talk through the different functional areas and different kinds of audits we do, it all links right back to that concept of establishing fiscal accountability, using public money to the best advantage, and that frugality and economy in public office.
And so it is your opinion from the totality of Mr. Shepherd's comments that this takes into account both fiscal audits as well as performance audits.
That's right, as long as there's a fiscal tie to it, the performance audit.
Make the link for me for the technology piece of this.
Okay. And a part of that is when, you know, our audit standards, I was going to talk about this, throwing off the tangent. Our information technology audits, a big chunk of what we do is required by our audit standards. When we do our financial audit work, we're attesting to the accuracy and validity of the information and the numbers coming out of the systems. And over time, our audit standards have said that in order to do that, we used to be able to go back and pull vouchers and invoices, match those up, and say that, yes, these numbers are credible, are reliable. But now what we need to do is actually look at the numbers that are coming out of the information system. And so we do, from audit standards, are required to go in and do some audit work to attest to the controls over the computer system, not just the fiscal controls that we used to go look at, the segregation of duties and those sort of things. And so a big chunk of the work that we do is required by audit standards in that area.
In order to enlighten this whole conversation, because I think this is going to be an issue that will be of interest not only to the panel but also to the co-chairs and I dare say the body, I have exercised the prerogative of the chair and accelerated Mr. Ruttlinger's appearance, and I think it might be instructive to the committee to just have the conversation, because there seems in some places to be some lack of clarity about exactly what the scope of the authority is. And to the degree that we can settle on that, I think it will help instruct this budget and move us along.
Sounds good. And maybe as I'm talking through each different type of audit we do, we kind of keep tying it back to
good.
The language that's here.
And then we'd ask the committee to just keep this document handy, and we can use it as a kind of base of the conversation.
Great.
Cool. Okay.
And then kind of what I wanted to do is then link that to, I brought my audit Bible with me, which is the government audit standards. This is what we do all of our work by. But there's a really good section in here that I just wanted to read really quickly.
Why don't you help us before you read from that document? That is issued by, who's the authority that issues that?
The United States General Accounting Office, or
thank
the
you.
Government Accountability Office. They just changed their name. It's the government audit standards that we do all of our audit work by.
Thank you.
They have a section in here about accountability, and it says, you know, the concept of accountability for public resources is key in our nation's governing process. Legislators and other government officials and the public want to know whether government resources are managed properly and are used in compliance with laws and regulations. Government programs are achieving their objectives and desired outcomes, and government services are being provided efficiently, economically, and effectively. And the managers of programs are accountable to the legislative bodies and the public, and that the auditors of these programs provide reports that enhance the credibility and reliability of the information that's reported by or obtained from officials of the audited entity. And that's kind of that key to that accountability process, and it's, you know, that concept of fiscal accountability way back when in the territorial statutes, having somebody there to attest to and look at the information provided to public officials so you can make good decisions based on quality information. And that's kind of the link between what we do here at the Audits Division and your role as legislators. So I brought my Bible. It's handy if you need it. What I thought I'd do is...
Ms. Winner, it might be useful to the committee to, during the course of the 3 days that the Secretary's office is here, for you to make a copy of that, if you would, and provide it to the professional staff, and they'll get it distributed to the committee. I just think that's a useful document for everybody to have in their file. Thanks.
The other handout we had was just this... Sorry it's this way, but let's see if we can work that for you. This just gives you an overview of our office performance measures and how it all links up to our mission, our vision, our goals, and the different audits that we do. The budget document that we put together, all these pieces are kind of pulled apart in different sections. So this one pager hopefully just pulls it all together so you can see that where the different measures are and how it all links into the our own internal processes. We did adopt the National State Auditors Association's performance measures, and we take this really seriously as part of our management process. I wasn't planning on going through all of these unless, Madam Chair, you want to dig into any of those.
I think that's fine.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morse.
A question arises is, if we were to look at this enterprise as a publicly held corporation, which essentially we are, we just don't have shareholders, that has annual operating revenues of, somewhere around $24-25 billion a year, annual revenue. And if we were to look at this in terms of the requirements of the Securities Exchange Commission in terms of internal audits and external audits, what would be the amount that a corporation of that size would spend in the auditing function, internally as well as external? And then benchmark that against the, I just very quickly looked at, what are we close to, $12 million biannually for the audits function, $6 million a year for a $25 billion a year company. It would be interesting to benchmark us against the private but publicly held corporation to see how we compare. Now, I know that we have internal audit functions that are within specific to, within agencies, so they're doing their own, and that's common also in large corporations. But to the extent that you might have that information to put us in perspective in terms of, protecting the public trust, the shareholders of this corporation, it could be very illuminating.
Yes, and Senator Morse, a partial response to this is that you'll see that it varies dramatically out there. I've got friends that are the chief auditors at Nike, at West Coast Bank, at Standard Insurance, and they all have very different size audit shops even within, those corporations. And I think you'll see that it just, and I know all my colleagues in other states, we have some states that have very, very small audit shops and some that have 400 auditors that do the work. And so, I don't know where a benchmark would land on all of that. It would be an interesting question.
Well, I think it would, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
I think it could be very instructive because as I've thought about this issue in the role of an independent Secretary of State versus the legislature's responsibility, it seems to me that we're maybe going down the wrong path to think about putting us in competition, but look at it in terms of its total scope, maintaining the independence and the function of the Secretary of State's office, and then also enhancing what it is that we need on the legislative side. But to put it in the context of large, complex, and we are very complex, obviously, if we were an SEC regulated enterprise, we were very complex. And how would we compare to that publicly traded sector? And I don't know what the answers would be, but my guess is that we're probably a little light.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, the other piece of that, too, is that it's not just the size, because sometimes when you're looking at it from an audit perspective, it's kind of the complexity of the operations. You know, if you have, you might have a very, very large organization that does one thing. You know, corrections is one example. Is they're you know, they're a large entity, but there isn't a lot of different kinds of programs as opposed to like Department of Human Services, which is large and has many different kinds of programs. The audit requirements for those two different entities, it's not based on necessarily size, but complexity. Yeah.
Before I invite Mr. Ruttlinger, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, how much of your audit work do you contract out? And where do you make the decision that you have the capacity to do it in-house versus a desire to seek expertise in some area, auditors that have expertise? For example, you mentioned DHS. That's a pretty esoteric area. Talk to me about how you make those decisions.
Madam Chair, that's a great question. We have, and I'm going to use real rough numbers, but approximately 10% of our budget is contract audit dollars. And part of the work that we do is very cyclical in nature. Our financial work, it comes July 1, the books are closed, and then we start a lot of our financial work. And so a lot of our audit staff shift over and work on our financial audit work, and we have this big lump of work that needs to be done between, like, July and November. And so part of what we do there is use some of our contract auditors to help even out some of that workload because, you know, frankly, the contract auditors, their hourly cost is a lot more than ours. And we have actually competed with them for a couple times for some of our audit work, and the folks that were looking at it chose us because they liked the quality of our work a little bit better. But we do use our contract auditors to help us in those peak audit seasons to kind of lower that peak, or to provide expertise in those areas that we don't have on staff. An example is our state accident insurance fund. We're required to do an independent actuarial review, and we don't have on staff actuaries that can do that work, and it's not year-round work either. So we do contract out for that kind of work when it is a specialty that we don't have on staff, and then also to help us with that peak season.
Do you generally contract with auditors, outside auditors, who have expertise? I mean, what I'm trying to get at, you wouldn't hire somebody that hadn't done an audit in some issue area in DHS who had no experience, would you? I mean, you'd search out firms that...
Madam Chair, yes, we look for ones that have some kind of experience. It depends on the audit work. Like some of the work is something an auditor can pick up and follow the prescription to it. But we do have some audit firms that are very skilled in areas like maybe university system accounting. They might have done one of the universities in another state, and so they have some expertise in that specialized accounting. So we would hire those firms that have that background to do a university system audit, or a retirement system audit has its own different accounting type knowledge needed. So, we do look at the expertise. And
is a requirement for expertise always built into your scope or your RFP?
And audit standards always require that the firm doing the work itself has to have the special, the skills of staff necessary to do the work. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Avakian. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's do Representative Avakian and then Senator Morissette, who I've slighted now twice.
You said the standards require, and I'm just curious, have we adopted that by our own administrative rule so that we're bound by it, or is the booklet a guideline for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, government audit standards are required for our financial statement opinion audits, and we have chosen to follow government audit standards for our performance audits. It's just that it keeps the bar at a certain level.
But I'm not sure you answered his question. You have chosen or you have...
It's not a requirement in law.
We have not adopted them by rule. Mm-hmm. We have not adopted them by rule, correct?
We've not adopted them. May I, for just... because we're dealing with federal money, are we required to use these standards by the federal government? Because we use federal money,
Madam Chair and Representative Akin, that's a part of it. In any of our opinion audits where we're issuing an opinion on financial statements, those need to be done in accordance with professional auditing standards, which include government auditing standards and then others that are the Government Accounting Standards Board issues, other audit standards that apply to different kinds of audit work.
Now, Senator Moore, second, my apologies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a follow-up on Senator Morris's questioning. I think you should provide also the salary level of the equivalent positions that you are going to track between the private and public sectors. You mentioned some of your friends at Nike and some of those places, and I think I've long felt that the Treasurer's Office and Secretary of State's Audit Division are training grounds for the private sector. And I'm kind of curious about what the pay equivalency is in those equivalent kinds of expertise areas.
And Madam Chair, Senator Moore said there's a lot of salary surveys out there that have those that information.
Good. As long as we're still having this kind of high-level conversation about the scope and authority for audits, I'm going to ask Mr. Ruttlinger from Legislative Council to join us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You hadn't been in the room when we first began the conversation, but there has been some debate about the scope and the authority of the Secretary of State's office with respect to a whole spectrum of audits. And Ms. Galino this morning went over a May 2nd memorandum over Pete Shepard's signature discussing the scope and authority. And we've invited you this morning to make any comments with respect. I don't know whether you've seen this document, and that might put you at a bit of a disadvantage, or whether you had the opportunity to review it in the back of the room.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. I read it quickly. It does summarize the various Attorney General opinions that discuss the scope of the Secretary of State's audit authority. I don't know how much you want to know. I sort of had a prepared, you know, couple-minute thing to talk to you about. But basically what most of those opinions talk about is the difference between the Secretary of State's authority to conduct fiscal or financial audits versus the Secretary of State's independent authority to engage in performance or program auditing. The memo, as I quickly read it, is an accurate description of what the AG's opinions have said, which is basically that the Secretary of State has constitutional authority to be the auditor of public accounts, and the Secretary of State's office has interpreted that to mean, I'm sorry, the Attorney General's office has interpreted that to apply to financial audits, to fiscal audits, to looking at money coming in, money going out, the accounts of the state. These Attorney General opinions have uniformly concluded that there is no independent constitutional authority for the Secretary of State to engage in performance auditing, independent performance auditing of public agencies. However, the opinions have said that when it's necessary for the Secretary of State to look at performance as part of a fiscal audit, that that's okay. So it gets a little bit complicated there, but the bottom line of these opinions seems to be that the Secretary of State's authority is constitutional. It covers fiscal and financial audits, which means the legislature cannot pass a law that in any way diminishes that authority. It also means that the legislature can't pass a law that diminishes the Secretary of State's ability to do performance auditing when it's part of a financial audit. However, it also means that there is no independent constitutional authority for the Secretary of State to conduct independent performance auditing. That authority has to come from statute, and it does currently in Chapter 297 with relation to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. So that's a real quick summary of my reading of those opinions.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Specifically, then, if the Secretary of State's office was to independently engage in performance audits of K-12 outside of a financial review or audit, would that be outside the scope of the constitutional authority and statutory authority?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, if the, as I understand it, the current statutes authorize the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to work with the Secretary of State's office to conduct various performance audits. If the Secretary of State were to begin simply a performance audit that has nothing to do with financial auditing, that would raise a legal question about their authority to do that. If they were conducting that performance review in the context of a financial audit, which the Secretary of State's office has total discretion about whether or not they're going to conduct that, then that would be a purely legal performance audit. Does that answer your question?
Representative Vaca.
Curious as to the definition of public accounts and how far up or down the chain that goes with regard to political subdivisions of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I believe that it goes from the top to the bottom. There's an AG's opinion that does talk about the auditing of school districts, and so I haven't looked specifically at that question, but I'm assuming that, that the term public accounts covers the range of political subdivision.
Hypothetically, then that would include, for instance, the city of Hillsborough.
Hypothetically, yes.
I didn't choose Hillsborough for any particular reason, except that it's a political subdivision of the state. How about counties or park and recreation districts or water districts, any of those other government entities?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, those are all public bodies whom I'm assuming would be covered by the public accounts language in the Constitution.
And may I have one more? Even though we're getting away from political subdivisions, hypothetically, what about governments that are above us? For instance, Federal Department of Agriculture that does business in the state of Oregon, that would have accounts in the state of Oregon, even though they are not an entity of the state of Oregon. Does public accounts go beyond the parameters of our state government?
Madam Chair, Representative Austin, I would think not. I don't think that the Oregon Constitution can grant the Secretary of State the authority to audit the federal government or units of the federal government.
Okay. So it's from us down.
Okay. Thank you. If you have prepared remarks, said you had...
I pretty much covered it.
Okay. I didn't want to truncate anything you worked on. Okay. All right. With that, I think we'll move on. We would invite you to stay in the room if you were so inclined, recognizing that your office has a lot to do. We would also give you leave to go back to work.
I'll hang up for a little while.
Senator Morissette.
One other question before you leave. An extension downward that Representative Austin referred to, how about state funds going to a nonprofit organization? For instance, the Emerald Art Association of the City of Springfield received a $300,000 grant. Do you have an opportunity, or do you have an obligation, or would you be able to audit that organization to see if the money was being spent properly? Or,
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I don't know the specific answer to that question. I'm confident that the Secretary of State's office would have the authority to audit the expenditure of the money going out. I'm not certain that they would have the authority to audit the actual internal affairs of a nonprofit organization.
That answered my question.
However, it has occasioned another question for me, and I would invite either one of you to answer it. Not-for-profit receives state money.
and there are questions about how that money is expended, what entity can trigger the audit function? And let me be less oblique. Transportation district in my legislative district received ODOT senior and disabled transportation money. It came through the county commission, went to this 501c3 with no trail of where the money was spent. As best I can tell, no rides delivered. And so I obviously have an interest in finding out some nice old ladies waiting at the end of the lane for a ride that never came. What's the trigger mechanism to ask that that audit occur?
Well, Madam Chair, there can be any real trigger to an audit. If we chose to do the audit work, my understanding is that we can follow that trail of money until the very end of where it goes. And so we could, upon request, follow that money all the way through to the...
That's the piece I'm getting at. Upon request, a letter from Senator Betsy Johnson triggers that, or is there a more formalized mechanism? What I'm trying to figure out is how do you not become the audit arm, extension of 90 legislators, running around doing sort of haphazard audits wherever they felt that they wanted to track the money?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. The statute set up the Joint Legislative Audit Committee for that specific purpose. And one of their major responsibilities is to accept requests from audits from various legislators, work on prioritizing those requests, and then work with us and Legislative Fiscal to get those audits done. We do have a limited amount of resources for audits. And so that was the mechanism that was established in statute to help funnel those requests. That mechanism hasn't been working to its full potential yet, and that's something that we would encourage, having that body working in that form.
I guess I would respond to you not having the privilege of sitting on that committee when you say it's not working to its fullest potential. What your suggestions might be to make it work to its fullest potential? Are there more requests than there are people and money to deliver? Is there a failure to communicate between that committee and your office? When you say it's not working to its fullest potential, I think it just invites the question, what's wrong?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. There is a bill out there to make this a standing committee during session. That's number one, would be one of the first best steps to this, because what happens is we go through session where a lot of the best audit ideas come up during session, but audits end up getting popped into bills and put into various places, and they don't go through that conscious vetting process of what's the highest priority audits to do. And then, you know, after session, especially this last one that went a little long, by the time the committees got set up and established again, it was, you know, we only had a few months left in the interim to do any real work before session started again. And so by the time we got organized and got going, got the new members up to speed on what audits are, there really wasn't that opportunity to get that mind process working of what are some good audit topics that are of interest to the legislative body. And so we kind of ran out of time, and then session started again. And so that's the piece of it that I think if that bill gets through and makes us a standing committee, I think would really help. And then we also have one of the option packages we're going to talk about a little later was dedicating some resources specifically to do that work so that the body knows that they have X number of hours of audit work to, you know, during the interim to get some work done.
That was very helpful. I would appreciate it. I think the whole panel would. You just described two sources of audit recommendations to your office. One of them is falling out of legislation, and the other is falling out of the Joint Legislative Committee. Could you bring us, hopefully tomorrow, the list of those audits that were required by legislation and the status of all of those, and the list that, even though you have described it as not being able to be fully realized because of the time limitations, the list of audits that fell out of the recommendations from the Joint Audit Committee?
Madam Chair, there weren't any requests that came out of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that we haven't fulfilled, so there isn't outstanding audit topics.
Then fine. If you could list what they directed you to audit and simply indicate that they're completed.
Okay.
Madam Chair, one other question.
Senator Morsett.
Thank you. Do you have an example of this type of audit where you track the money that went to a nonprofit that was questioned?
Not quite yet, Mr. Reitlinger.
I see lawyer to lawyer questioning about it.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think maybe probably one of the best examples is we recently did an investigation looking at a grant that Housing sent to, and I'm trying to remember what the entity was.
Hope it wasn't St. Vincent de Paul.
No, I think it was. I'm trying to remember. But what we were looking at is whether those funds were used for the purposes allowed in the grant as it went out from Housing, and found that they were using those funds for other purposes. So that was an example of an audit where we've traced the money all the way through. Good.
Thank you.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get a clearer handle on to what extent you see your governing authority as auditors. And the Attorney General opinions describe you as being the exclusive auditor of public accounts, and you even highlight the word exclusive in your memo to us. So when I ask the question about political subdivisions like the city of Hillsborough, for instance, would it be your interpretation that you are the exclusive auditor of all of these political subdivisions of the state? And if not, at what point do you draw the line on your exclusivity?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, that's something that's been described over time. State funds is what is in our purview, is the use of state funds and following that to its logical end. We do oversee the audits that are done by we oversee the municipal audit law for the state, which covers cities, counties, school districts, water districts, fire districts. Those audits in the state of Oregon are done by private CPA firms, with our office overseeing that work. So that's kind of the separation, is if it's a municipality, which there's over 1,600 of those in the state of Oregon, those are done by local CPA firms. Those reports are sent to us, and we oversee the work of those firms.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Then I'm guessing by what you said that you don't see yourself as the exclusive auditor of those, meaning if a city council, unlike the legislature, wanted to preclude you from overseeing their accounting, that you think they would have the authority to do that under this Attorney General opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, the Attorney General opinion I don't think covers that case. There is municipal audit law in statute that talks about cities and counties and municipalities and the audit requirements. For example, the citizens of a municipality can petition to have an audit done by our office with a certain number of signatures.
Why, may I just for a moment?
Please, just go ahead.
This is why I'm not trying to put too fine a point on the legal distinctions here, but this is why it seems important to me, is that because when I asked you earlier if you would consider those local accounts public accounts, and I think your answer was yes,
was
yes, that they were, then the wording is so clear that you've relied on a number of times in hearings with us as being the exclusive auditor of public accounts. If those are public accounts at those local levels and receive state money in all kinds of indirect ways, then you have public accounts with state money, but you're not considering yourselves the exclusive auditor of those like you are the exclusive auditor for money in this building, the accounts in this building. And I'm having just a little trouble figuring out what the distinction is between the state money at those local levels and the state money at this level, and the language that you're relying on to show your, for lack of a better word, sovereignty from us legislators. Do you follow my question?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, it's not my testimony that we're the auditor of all local government accounts.
Okay. Mr. Rettlinger, I would invite any comment of yours.
Madam Chair, Ted Rettlinger, Legislative Council. It's clear under the Constitution that the Secretary of State is the auditor of public accounts with respect to state agencies, state money. That's exclusive. It's also true that the statute set up the municipal audit law, which was accurately described, allowing local CPA firms to audit cities, counties, districts, everybody who's defined in that law as a municipality. I don't know the specific answer to the question with respect to whether or not an account in a city, for example, is a considered a public account under the Constitution. It seems to me that, clearly following the state money is covered, whether or not the Secretary of State is the exclusive has exclusive constitutional authority to audit public funds in cities or counties is a question that I don't know, but I can find out and come back.
On behalf of the committee, I'd like to ask you to do that, not exhaustively, but to help enliven this debate. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just 2 seconds.
Just one final statement, then I'm done with this. The reason it's important is because the statutes you're talking about governing those local accounts were passed by the legislature, which would then imply that the legislature does have the authority to potentially limit your exclusive control of public accounts. And that's why it seems to me that that's an important question to have answered.
Does that give you enough to work with?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you. To follow up specifically with respect to the policy option package request for K through 12 performance audits, Mr. Ellinger, based on your previous comments, if the Secretary of State's decision, or if the Secretary of State decision was to do financial audits of K through 12 with existing revenues, exclusive of approving the policy option package of $1.3 million, but just within that general funding, chose to do performance audits in conjunction with financial audits in the K through 12 system or local districts, then I understand from your testimony that that would in fact be consistent with constitutional authority. Is that,
Madam
that
Chair, Senator Morris, I believe that that's a correct statement. Again, the Secretary has unlimited constitutional authority to conduct financial audits. If in the context of a financial audit, the Secretary determines that they need to look at performance, then that does fall within their constitutional authority according to the Attorney General opinions.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, if I could just add one comment here, which is I think the issue on doing audits of K-12 schools is really a funding issue. We currently assess all state agencies for our audit services. And we don't audit every state agency every year. Everybody pays sort of a piece, and we then have the ability to do audits. The issue is, if we're going to start doing audits and performance audits of K-12 schools, how do we pay for it? And that's essentially what the real issue is here, which is that we're proposing to, just like we do with state agencies, spread the cost amongst all school districts through an allocation from basic school support. That's really the issue in the auditing K-12 schools.
Senator Morse.
A follow-up. Do you have the authority to do that?
Authority
let me rephrase the question. It's a funding issue. The question is, do you have existing authority to charge them for the audit that they don't want? I suspect that you do not have the existing authority.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think the answer is yes, we do have the authority to bill them. We don't think that's a very equitable way to do auditing and just bill individual school districts for the cost of that audit.
Do have the authority.
However, they could request it.
They could request
as
it.
As a fee for service.
Yes, certainly they could.
One more when you're done, Madam Chair.
I'm done. Representative Avakian.
Since these Attorney General opinions have become such a focal point within these hearings, I think it would be good for the record just to have you explain what binding authority you think these Attorney General opinions have on you or us or anybody. And I would be happy to direct that to Mr. Reutlinger, not you, Mr. Secretary, but any at the table, certainly.
Just one, Madam Chair, Representative Bakken, just one comment, which is it is interesting to note that in the Attorney General's the summary that Pete Shepard wrote, there really isn't any specific court decisions to guide this. What we have is a series of opinions from the Attorney General for, you know, Republican Secretary of State, Democratic Secretary of State, Republican Secretaries of State dealing with Democratic legislatures. I mean, very bipartisan kind of set of opinions. That's really all we have. We don't have any specific, what would you call it, case law from the court.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think this was very interesting. And, again, I invite you to stay if you'd like to stay, Mr. Reutlinger, whatever works for you. Ms. Polino, we've now interrupted your prepared presentation about 60 gazillion ways. So if you can find where you are and guide us back so we're with you.
Madam Chair, and I might probably, I'm going to end up throwing one more monkey wrench into all this, because one of the key points that I think we need to keep in mind with all of these opinions and all the information going on is that I always hear a confusion between financial statement opinion audits and audits to ensure fiscal accountability. They are two, I mean, there's pieces of them that are the same, but if you go back to the territorial statutes, it does not say that all we can do is financial statement opinion audits. And sometimes those things end up getting linked together, is that you can only do audits if they are opinion audits of financial statements. And if you look at that territorial statute, it doesn't talk about auditing just the financial statements. It talks about doing audits to ensure fiscal accountability, ensuring that public funds are used to their best advantage, promoting frugality in economy and in public office. That is a what we call now today performance audits that have fiscal ties to them. So, you know, I just want to make sure that as we talk about, you know, all these Attorney General opinions that go over time, there's never a mention of going back over time and having the territorial auditor doing strictly financial statement opinion audits. They do fiscal accountability audits, and that's what we link to. There are some performance audits you can do that don't have fiscal ties, but that's not the kinds of work that we ourselves look into doing. We do those audits of looking at economy, efficiency, use of public resources, use, are they being used for legal purposes? Are they being used wisely? So and I know that'll stir up more debate, but that's the piece that I think I want to make sure that we don't keep getting tangled up in, is that it's not necessarily a financial statement opinion audit. It's an audit for fiscal accountability. And with that, let's what I thought I'd do is go down your priority list and just hit the various audit areas that are listed in here. And the first one on the first page, the third item down, we've got everybody on the same. It's your list of our programs within.
Right, it's the long list that was provided in everyone's office by legislative fiscal.
Just go ahead. I shall share. Oh, thank you.
I thought that might be the easiest way so that we're all on the same page. Let's go ahead and talk about financial audits since we're right on board with that. One of the biggest audits that we do in our office is the audit of the state's comprehensive annual financial report. We also do financial opinion audits of a couple other state agencies, mostly those that issue bonds, so that bond rating authorities can have an opinion audit tied to that. Another big piece of this work that we do is back in the mid-80s, Congress passed the Single Audit Act because each of the federal cognizant agencies used to send their auditors in to audit various federal programs. The state auditors were in auditing their audits. And so the Single Audit Act of the mid-1980s said that, you know, the Secretary of State Audits Division is going to be the single auditor of public accounts on behalf of the federal government. So that's one of the conditions of us receiving more than $6 billion in federal money, is that we do audit work on behalf of the federal government. And that's another piece of the work that we do here as part of this audit work. One of the things that I think is important to understand as far as resources is that we talked a little bit about this, is it's very cyclical in nature. A lot of our staff in the audits division move over and work on our financial audit work during that financial peak season, and then they work on this other kind of audit work that we have during the off season. And I think at its peak, we have about three quarters of our office working just on our financial statement work. Another thing that is happening with kind of our resources here is this is the work that we have to do. I mean, there's no leeway as far as doing this or not doing this. And over time, our total audit resources have been, you know, slowly shrinking. I think over the last 10 years, we've lost, we were about 85 and a half staff, and, you know, we've lost a couple staff here and there. So our total pie of audit hours available, and this last year has been very, very difficult with being second year of a pay freeze. We've had a lot of vacancies, too, in our office. So our available audit hours has shrunk. But then within that, the work that goes to do our financial opinion work not only has stayed the same, it's also increased. In kind of the wake of the Enrons and the WorldComs, the standard-setting boards for the audit work that we need to do to issue that same single financial statement has increased. And so we've had the shrink of our total resources, and within that, the financial work has grown. So what's available to do, all the rest of the audit work we're going to be talking about, has shrunk over the last 3 years. When you look at the total number of FTE that we have in each of these audit areas, you know, a piece of that is that, you know, realize that some of our staff move from these areas during different times of the year. But also, this is how we would use our 0507 staff if we were fully funded and, you know, anytime we have vacancies or anything like that, this work will still get done, but everything else will get shrunk up. And just a brief example is 3 years ago.
Ms. Quinn, let me ask you, if you're given a rise in the amount of work you have to do, diminution of staff, and yet in some of the requests that you have pending in this legislative session, you seem to be just augmenting your work.
Mm-hmm.
Help me reconcile that.
Madam Chair, and that's where... You mean our option packages that we have here?
Mm-hmm.
These are areas that we feel are very important areas that need to be audited, and I'll talk about a couple of those as we peel through the list. But we simply just don't have those resources available to do it. And so we have laid them out for all of you to look at and say, here's the work that we are not able to get to with our existing resources. Here's where we would recommend adding audit resources to get to this work.
Okay, I think I'll more finely nuance my question when we get there.
Okay.
Senator Morrison.
No.
Okay.
And just a brief example, if we go back just 3 years ago, financial statement opinion work took up about 38% of our total resources, both staff and audit dollars. And then this last year, it was 61% of our resources were consumed by our financial statement work. So it's a big shift for us, and it really shrinks our ability to do all the other work we're going to talk about.
Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize what Ms. Bolino just said. We've gone from 38% of our audit resources for financial opinion work to 61%, which is, yeah, I think, it's mm-hmm. pretty clear.
And I believe this last year it's probably going to be even higher than that once we get the numbers in. I think our next section is on your fourth page. It says municipal. I hope our pages look about the same. Mine's a little bit different. Everybody see where it says municipal audits? We talked about this a little bit earlier. In the state of Oregon, the municipal audits, which are the county, city, school district, water districts, those are all audited by private sector CPA firms. Those audit reports come to our office, and we basically make sure that all the reports that need to be done are done, and then we do some desk reviews to see if the work is done according to professional audit standards. So we oversee the work.
Do you give any technical assistance to these units of government that are retaining CPA firms?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. In fact, our large staff of two that do this work. He's got his headphones on all the time because he is fielding hundreds of phone calls every week, both from local boards, from the city councilors themselves or from the CPA firms. He provides a lot of assistance and advice as far as what kind of audit work needs to be done and how they need to do it to comply with audit standards. So a lot of the work that we do is simply that overseeing the program and providing some assistance.
Thank you.
And then this is really the only program that we have is funded by separately by fees. The fees that are paid by the municipalities pay for this oversight of this program.
And how have those fees been recently? If I'm a water district somewhere retaining a CPA to do my work and you're charging me for oversight, how consistent or are they rising?
Last session, I believe, I can't remember if it was last session or the session before, we raised the fees for the first time in 800 years, it seems like. But they are very minimal fees, the amount that they pay to us. And I think the large, I can't even remember off the top of my head, but I could get that for you.
If they're minimal, do they cover your costs?
They do, because there are 1,600 municipalities out there. So the small fee that they do pay covers the cost of these staff.
Senator Morset.
Thank you. How closely do you work with the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Special District Association? Do you work with them?
Madam Chair, Senator Morset, most of our work is with the Oregon Society of CPAs and the ones that are actually doing the audit work themselves.
Well, let me rephrase the question then, if I may. Do they contact you then on behalf of their members concerning your policies, and do they work with you to improve or to change and so on? Rather than, you know, the city, rather than contacting you, might go to the League of Oregon Cities and say, we need help.
Madam Chair, Senator Morset, yeah, I think we do quite a bit of that work, but again, most of it is on the audit side, and the laws haven't changed a lot for a long time, so I think people are pretty used to the way it works.
Thank you.
Senator Morse.
If I do the math, that amounts to $168 per municipality fee, fee.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I believe it goes anywhere from $50 to $500 for the largest.
The
right. Okay, I'll keep going. On the next page, performance audits is at the top. The work that we do here falls mainly into two buckets. One is work that we call our fiscal accountability work, where we're looking at whether programs are being operated economically and efficiently. And I just thought I'd give an example of the latest audit that we issued was an audit looking at debt write-offs. Agencies, they attempt to collect their debts, and then after a certain period of time, they write them off. But even if they're written off, they're still owed to the state. And so we took a look to see if there was maybe some potential for collection of some older write-off debts. And looking at the different character of the debts that were out there, we found that the debts owed by higher ed would be probably good collectible debts after a certain period of time. So we went ahead and did the match, found over $1 million of debts that were written off that weren't being worked by the university system, had people that were here in Oregon, working in Oregon, and so we recommended that they change their process so that they kind of reconstitute the debt every once in a while. One of the nice things that came out of this audit is as we were working on this with the Department of Revenue, they said, you know, hey, wait, we've got this pile of debt that we're not currently actively working. Could you apply some of the same audit work that you just did for higher ed? So we went in and did a match of their accounts that they have sitting there that they really weren't actively working, and found, you know, over $11 million of debt that they weren't actively working had people employed in Oregon with current wages that were above the poverty limit. So that was, to me, a good win-win that, you know, they asked us to come in and take a look at it, and we were able to show them a tool that can help them with their collection activities.
I'm having a hard time reconciling what you just said with the fact that it was my belief that at a certain point debt is to be turned over to private collection agencies rather than just stockpiled someplace and not worked. Right. And I don't know the answer to the question.
Madam Chair, this is debt that's already been sent to either private collection agencies or has been sent to the Department of Revenue, and they've already worked on it. They've exhausted all their collection activities. They've written it off. but then after a certain period of time, this debt might become more collectible. And the reason we found the university system debt more collectible is you might have college debts, you know, students that leave school that might not have jobs right away. They might have attempted to collect on these debts, but maybe 5-10 years later, these might be collectible debts, even though they weren't at the time. So we think there's something they should take a look at. And
Madam Chair, I'd love to tell the story that they, in their audit of higher ed, they found one person at an old university, I think it was $1,000, that had a current income of $240,000 a year, which is, of course, what you want from having people go to college, is that they raise their income. I think that person could probably pay.
Mm-hmm. Tell me you got him.
I can't tell you that.
So, anyway, one example, that's the kind of work that we do with regards to economy and efficiency, looking for those sort of things. A second piece of the type of work we do for performance audits, kind of called program...
Let me stop you. That's a fascinating story that you've just told. Where did the idea to do that originate? You're being given direction by the legislature in certain pieces of legislation that pass. In a normal cycle, you're given direction by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Who initiated this inquiry?
This one in particular was one that our audit shop, you know, during the course of our audit work, we go through, and every 6 months we look at our queue of audits, and we say, well, what are the audits that are sitting in our queue? What are some additional topics that either came up during the course of other audits, audits that might have come through our hotline, because we do get some phone calls through our government waste hotline, requests we get from agency managers. Sometimes we get phone calls saying, you know, I've got a program here that I'd like you to come take a look at. This one in particular was one of our responsibilities in statute is when agencies want to write off debt, they have to send it to our office. And so I see all of the debt that's getting written off comes across my desk. And this is one that I kept looking at and saying, you know, over time, I wonder if this stuff is collectible after a certain period of time. And so we went ahead and did an automated match to see if there's some potential there. And then from that, we saw that there was some indication there might be some good potential, so we went ahead and initiated the audit.
I think then I've asked a question incorrectly, particularly as I looked at the material that you provided for the committee. What I really am interested in is the audit queue that you have. What's queued up, and where's the source of the ask? Because this doesn't tell me where this came from at all. This is follow-up on K-12 education spending. It tells me the description, field work, and the end of May 05. Mm-hmm. I don't know what originated it. I don't know where it is in your queue. So I've asked my question incorrectly. I want to know the queue.
Okay.
And if you'd make that available to Monica, and she can give the whole committee.
Great.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
That raises another question that you may have the answer for. Do we reward individuals who come up with money-saving ideas? Is this part of our overall state program to encourage people to... That's the best source of ideas, you know, people who are on the front line.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there is an employee suggestion award program, but generally speaking, we have our best tips are those folks that are out there at the state agencies, the ones that are, you know, they many of them want some kind of avenue to when they see something, to be able to tell somebody about it. And so we do have people that are, you know, sometimes asked to do things that they're not comfortable with, or they see things happening in their work area that they don't agree with or don't, and they, you know, don't necessarily feel comfortable talking to their boss or going up the ladder. And so they have been the best source of the tips that come through the hotline are those folks that are in the agencies working. And, you know, many times they just want to do it not because they see some kind of a monetary reward coming, but just because, you know, they take pride in their work and they feel bad about some of the things they see. Okay. Another just kind of category of performance audits, you know, we talked about the fiscal accountability work. The other second piece is, I guess it's called program results, and I just wanted to give you one example from there. In 1997, the legislature established a pilot project in Deschutes County for delinquent youth, and the 2001 Legislative Assembly wanted information on whether that pilot project was working. What we basically did is say, told the counties, you know, you take the youth instead of sending them to the Oregon Youth Authority, house them in your county, we'll send you the equivalent amount of funds that we would have used here in the state. And then what they wanted in 2001, the legislature said, is this working? Was this a pilot project that turned out? Is it something we want to expand to other counties, or is it something we want to discontinue? And so we conducted an audit looking at that program where we provided information on the costs of the program and the outcomes of the program. You know, what happened to the youth when they left? Did they reoffend? Did they get jobs? Did they finish their education? And I think this was a good example of where that independent source of information can help policymaking decisions. You know, when you're kind of struggling with, you know, we hear the program is a success from this side, and this side is saying it's not. We were able to come in and give some information for policymakers so you could make decisions on that. That's just another example of types of performance audits we do. Right underneath that is our financial management audits, and there's a bunch of different little pieces that fall into this. We do what we call resource management audits, which are things that our financial statement auditors do in the off season. Let's say during the course of our financial work, they notice cash controls are weak at a number of agencies. So we might do, as part of our resource management audit, take a look at agencies that do handle a lot of cash and target specifically cash controls. We also do, as part of this, what's called financial compliance work. And this is looking at whether funds that were spent according to what was allowed by law or by the Constitution. And just an example of that, I believe it was last session, might be the session before, there were some questions on whether cities and counties were using the 911 telephone tax for allowable purposes. And so we were asked to come in and do a compliance audit to look at how they were using the funds and whether they were using them for 911 emergency communications. And we did find that there was about $300,000 that was spent on other things within those cities and counties. So that's an example of kind of a financial compliance audit that we might do. And then finally also in here is change of director audits. This is another type of audit that's required by statute. And I don't know, Madam Chair, if you want to get into House bills or not, because House Bill 2027 was one that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in the last interim had a subcommittee get together to look at all of the audit mandates that were in law and recommend certain audits that may not be necessary or as beneficial as they maybe were 10, 20, 50 years ago when they were put into statute. So that House Bill 2027, this is one of those types of audits that the subcommittee recommended pulling out of statute. And so we do them. They're required by statute.
2027 would pull the change of director out.
Yes, except for the last amendment that I saw, that was actually put back in. So I don't know if the committee is going to be dealing with that because it was referred to Ways and Means. And at any point you'd like to talk about that, I would be happy to address those.
How many change of heads have you done audits?
I believe because right after the governor changes, there's usually a slew of agency heads that left. I believe over the last 3 years we've done somewhere in the neighborhood of 45, 46 change of director reviews.
And in how many of those were there any financial discrepancies?
There were a couple. The reason I think that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee felt that this isn't that necessary to have us review every single one of these is that those two were known to us by other matters. It wasn't because we were doing a change of director audit that we stumbled on problems. We knew there were problems, and we went in and did the work. So the thought is that we shouldn't necessarily be required to audit every single one of these because, you know, many times there aren't really problems.
I mean, in some cases, I was looking at one of these sheets you provided, a change of head where there was an interim during an executive recruitment.
Right.
And I'm just curious how much money would be spent on doing a review of that nature, an audit. Can you give us any idea?
Madam Chair, we've really scaled these back to a very high-level review. We call them change of director lights. You know, we used to do a lot more work. What we do is we basically look at things such as, you know, any contracts that they entered into the last few months of employment, any payments that went out to the director as far as, you know, both travel and payroll payments. And then we ask the agency to attest to us that they returned their computer and they've got them off the signature authority. So we're really asking them to attest to us what it is, and then we spot check those types of things. But, you know, we've got them down to, a very small, I think our target is to do them in 80 hours, but even that takes time.
80 hours to know if you turned in your keys and you didn't have a contract at the last 6 weeks?
Madam Chair, but most of it is looking at the contracts and looking at the payroll disbursements and, you know, ensuring that all the, you know, the payments were appropriate that took place at the end of the tenure.
Forgive me, I'm still incredulous that would take basically 2 weeks.
Madam Chair, most of the time it's you know, we're making a request to the agency and waiting for information to come back. So it's not that our auditors are working on this the entire time. They send out the letters, receive the information, and review it.
So it really might be 3 hours of work, but 80 hours of time
right.
has gone
time.
By, is what
that
you're
still
saying.
Is a bizarre way to account for things. The time it takes a letter to run across the Capitol, you count that as the total?
It's just
unusual.
A couple weeks? How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, that's in the yellow Bible.
It's in my Bible.
English church by that?
Yeah. By the waiting hour.
Yeah, by the waiting hour, we'd all be in deep trouble. Okay. One other thing that I think is important with any of these, particularly where there's some kind of a recommendation, I am thinking back to your example when you were talking about cash controls. That seems to me to be a very serious inquiry, area of inquiry. So you find a discrepancy. What's your process internally to ascertain that that discrepancy has been satisfactorily reconciled and you can, in effect, close the books on that issue?
Madam Chair, when we're looking at cash controls, those haven't been triggered by discrepancies. In the ones that I'm talking about, I guess these particular audits, what we were looking at, those agencies that do handle a lot of cash, we went in and looked at how they.
Let me be clear about my question then. You find an agency that handles an extraordinary amount of cash.
Yes.
You decide you want to go in and take a look. You realize there's only single person control of the cash. That clearly is a problem. You write them a management letter that says, please fix this. What's the closure mechanism? Do you say, please fix this in a week and report back? And then somebody ascertains that, in fact, now there's two-person control. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you've gone to the effort to do the review. You've made a recommendation. What's the closure mechanism?
Madam Chair, many of these things, especially with regards to cash handling, are things that agency management takes, you know, action on right away. We ask them to respond to our audit, what specific steps they're going to take as far as and including timelines and things that they're going to do. We do a follow-up 6 months later, a letter that goes out to ask them to report to us what they have done in response. But many of these things are, they're not immediate serious problems, but we have found that agencies jump on the ones that are you know, significant deficiencies right away. But yes, we do a follow-up on all of the audit work that we do.
Okay, thank you. Senator Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good morning. It's good seeing you. Earlier in the session, I was talking with a group of folks about the need to have senior-level managers take 1 week off and block and use that as a protection mechanism within our systems. To protect situations such as the handling of cash or the disbursement of checks. It's a practice commonly done in the banking industry. What would be your take on doing that here in the state of Oregon? What would be the limitations? What could be the advantages of doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure the programmatic impacts of doing something like that, so I'd hate to comment on that. But it is true that, you know, one of the biggest red flags that you're looking for when you're doing fraud investigations is those people that never take vacations.
Right.
You know, you do look for that because, you know, when they leave is usually the time that those investigations get triggered. And we had one of those recently. A gal that worked at Economic Development
right.
was perpetrating a fraud over a period of 10 years. And, you know, finally when she did take a little bit of time off, someone noticed that the checks were being written to herself. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that usually pop up, you know, when somebody else is required to step in and take over for someone. But I don't know if I could comment on the programmatic impacts of having people leave.
Without getting into the programmatic impacts, just from an auditor's perspective, do you think it would make sense to have a requirement similar to the banking industry? Trying to build support for this concept. Is to me, it just makes common. It's just common sense that those folks who are most apt to control a system also be the ones that we have a system in place to ensure that we're able to have them step aside just for a short period of time.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think it depends on what their responsibilities are, too. And, you know, those are the things that we are looking for, too, is that segregation of duties so that one person can't do many multiple things so that you can, you know, perpetrate and conceal something altogether.
Would this be an issue in the interim you'd be willing to work with me on just to investigate a little further for the next session?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith. Yep.
Perfect.
Definitely.
Thank you.
I would just like to note for the record before we continue that with ample time still remaining in the committee hearing, we have no one signed up for public testimony. We had noticed this as an opportunity for a public hearing and for the public to speak, and there is no one signed up, and so we're going to continue with the agency presentation, but I just want it noted that there was ample time left for public testimony. Please continue.
Madam Chair, on the next page, I'd like to talk about our investigations. This is a good lead into it since that's the next one up. There are a couple different roles that we play here. In fact, there are many different state agencies that play a role when there is a loss of public funds by a public employee.
Just to make sure, Ms. Polino, everybody's with you, I believe that you are on item 29 on page whatever it is.
That's correct.
I don't think they're numbered, but it's item 29.
Again, various different roles that different people are playing. Oregon State Police plays a role, obviously, in the investigation end of it. We've got the Attorney General and the local district attorneys that play a role in, you know, prosecuting these if they get to those stage. Risk management over at Department of Administrative Services has their own role. The role that we play when there is a loss of funds is two pieces. One is we want to ensure that the full extent of the loss is identified. Usually the other folks that we're working at are only interested in making sure they have enough evidence to prosecute and not necessarily going back to make sure that that full extent of the loss is covered. The second piece that we do, and it's probably the more important piece, is that we look at what were the controls that broke down that allowed this to happen and make recommendations back to the agency to prevent these sort of things from occurring in the future.
Let's take this out of the abstract and use an example. In one of the advocacy commissions, I believe there was a very serious problem. Could you comment on how, I mean, given there may be some ongoing investigatory constraints, but to the degree that you're able to comment, could you use that as a specific for the committee to understand how this investigatory function works?
Sure, Madam Chair, and as specific, as non-specific as I can be, because there is an ongoing investigation on this. But the role that we played, there was a very small board, and, you know, again, when we were talking about those controls, there are some very weak controls when you get down to single or two-person type shops. But State Police was investigating this particular incident along with us. And what our staff was able to bring to it, we have certified public accountants who are also certified fraud examiners. And the role that we played is we were able to go in and dig into the payroll records, the expenditure records, the accounting records, and look for problems and anomalies that we saw in the work. And when State Police then went, you know, a lot of the purchases and things that this entity was buying, wasn't in the office, and so state police got a subpoena, and we went out to the home of the person. Our auditors were there with a list of items that we found during the course of our work, and walked in with the state police and said, okay, first we're looking for a black bookcase thing, and we're also looking for this particular computer with these kinds of things. And so police was able to go around and pick off of our list those things that we found during the course of our audit work. I believe state police, during their testimony at their Ways and Means Subcommittee, talked about that good working relationship we have and how their folks aren't necessarily number people, and in fact they'd rather have somebody else performing that piece of the work. And so our office, with the types of individuals that we have and the role that we have to play as far as, you know, that accountability over the use of public funds, that link has been very good, and we have a very good working relationship with them. And they have told us, we have tons more work that we could use you guys on. And so unfortunately we don't have a ton of extra people sitting around to help them out, but we do have, and you'll see at the, I guess a couple down from here, we have put a pop into our package, because both our work with state police and knowing that there is more work that needs to be done out there, and other work that we have done, we do something called data mining, where we will take, say the state's credit card purchases, and we'll pull them down and we'll do queries on this, and we have piles and piles and piles of strange looking purchases that are driving us nuts as auditors, because we don't have time to track them all down. But, so we have picked off the big ones on there, but there is so much work that's sitting on our plate that needs to be done that we just don't have the resources to get to.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. So you don't do a fee for service with these agencies?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no, we don't.
Have you folks investigated a fee for service?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, many years ago we used to bill on an hourly basis to state agencies. What happened, though, is it created nightmares for budgeting purposes. Agencies ended up having to go to the e-board all the time whenever there was a large audit that took place. So this changed.
I don't mean to argue with you on this, but they created the nightmare.
Sometimes.
I mean, by perhaps not having the correct controls in place, mm-hmm. by not having, the correct controls in place, they created a situation where they now need you to come in, mm-hmm. and to determine the situation. To me, it seems like rather than putting a burden on the Secretary of State, the burden ought to fall on the agency that created the situation for themselves. Help me with what I'm missing there.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think the thought process when they changed our funding mechanism, I mean, there was those difficulties every time we went to do an audit. There were problems that took place. I think the other piece is that there was a thought that when we do the audit, there's more than just that one agency that benefits from the results of the audit. A lot of times we identify cash control weaknesses or things that we then go out and teach other agencies, you see what happened over here. So there was a benefit to more than just that one specific agency. And I think that was the thought process in changing the funding mechanism.
Before I go to Representative Vaki and Mr. McGuire.
And if I may, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. I think the other benefit that we see is we want to encourage agency heads to call us if they see a problem. And in the assessment formula, where it's paid for, they don't have to think, oh my goodness, if I call the Secretary of State, where am I going to find the money? I'm going to have to go to the e-board. We'd much rather have them pick up the phone and say, I need help.
Except, Mr. McGuire, respectfully, sometimes they don't know they need help until they're underwater.
So absolutely. But, there are several good examples, and let me give you a very, very brief one. Department of State Lands had a problem with their unclaimed property program. They started to scrape the surface and see that there was a problem, and they picked up the phone and they called us and said, help us.
That's a lot different, DSL, from the board of massage therapists. And I'm not picking on them particularly. I have no idea how many FTE they have. But Oregon has had this long tradition of these small boards and commissions. And there has been a lot of discussion in this committee about their responsibility with their own governing boards, giving the agency directors advice. There's been a lot of discussion among the health licensing boards about combining the back rooms so that there is common check writing, common accounting. The thing that I don't think we've touched on, and maybe we're sort of nibbling around the edges of it right now, is to the degree that they have appropriate fiscal control, sort of best business practices. And I'm not so sure that Representative Smith hasn't stumbled on something that would, I don't mean in that in a pejorative sense, has identified an issue.
You know what she means.
Yeah, exactly. Might warrant some additional discussion that you don't wait until it's too late. That I worry about all of these little boards and commissions operating for a variety of very good and useful purposes, including advocacy for their industry, and yet not understanding the principles of good governance or the principles of best business practices. And so I wouldn't mind asking the professional staff to tag this when we come back again and revisit what guidance this committee might give through a budget note to have you discuss some kind of fee for service and some encouragement for these little boards to just factor into their budget creation that the same way you'd pay for a lawyer, you may pay for some control expertise. I have just been informed that the House session commences at 10 o'clock this morning. I wasn't aware of that when we began the committee, and so we're going to excuse our two House members who have to go discharge that responsibility. I think we will continue on, if there are issues that we need to catch them up on tomorrow, we will do that, but we only have 3 days, and we have now expended the entirety of this session or will with audits. And I want to try to maintain some semblance of the schedule. So unless either one of you too strenuously object, we'll proceed ahead.
No,
I have one last question.
Please, Representative Smith.
You mentioned, you know, the need for these folks to come to the e-board. And I understand the psychology behind that. At the same time, as a member of a budget committee, I'd like to know there's a problem, and I'd like this agency to have to come before us and explain why they didn't have the controls in place, and to hold their feet to the fire and know that they're working with you folks to put those controls in place, because I think that message is going to help spread throughout the system as well, that you have an issue, you didn't take care of business, you now have to face the e-board, and you have to face the Secretary of State. And they're going to help you get those controls in place. I get the psychology. I do, and I don't have an argument for that because I do understand it. I also have the other side, and I don't know how to balance that.
Chair, can I piggyback on that before we leave and incorporate this into your answer? Sometimes I think we do have adequate systems in place, and the bad guys just do what they do. And
sure.
I think we heard you loud and clear that your FTEs are short in accomplishing everything you need. But absent that, do you have a sense about whether or not your systems are adequate to catch the bad guys as they are?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, absolutely not. I hate to admit this, but, you know, with 130-some state agencies and such a small level of staff, and, you know, with such a small slice of what we're actually able to look at, I would say that I cannot give you an assurance that we're catching everything that's out there. There is a piece to this that I want to caution us on a little bit, is that a lot of times agency managers, without having this avenue to go to, they'll handle it as a personnel matter. And the person will be discharged, we won't know about it, and off this person will go. And we have seen many cases where then they are reemployed by another state agency, and off they go again. So, you know, there's a fine balance that we need to strike between, you know, that communication level and how these issues are handled. You know, there is a requirement in the statute that they do contact us if there is a loss of funds. We don't know if we're always getting contacted, and that's the problem.
Thank you.
Last for the House, Representative Smith.
Is there a fraud hotline?
Mm-hmm.
How do employees know about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, in statute we're required to have posters posted all in every public place. So there is a little poster that hopefully is up everywhere. There's an 800 number, and there's also a, you know, fraud.oregon.gov is a website that they could go to.
I'll just give you a case in point. 15 years ago, I worked for OHSU in their storeroom, and I was a part.
Nine.
Yeah. And I was a part-time on-call hired to take the job of a secretary who was on maternity leave. And my first day on the job, I watched the manager walk right into the storeroom, grab a huge case of Pampers diapers, huge case of it, the size of this desk, and helped load them out to this person's car and said, chalk this one up as a loss or something. And I just sat there, and I never forgot that. And, you know, what message did that send to all the other employees? You know batteries were going home. You know, mercury was going home. And yet, at the time, I mean, somehow we have to let employees know there's a mechanism to report this type of situation, and it's not going to come back and bite them. And at the time, I'm sitting there thinking, this is dead wrong. I don't know who to call, and if I pick the wrong person, I'm now out of my summer job.
Yeah, and
that pays for college.
Our website is anonymous. Someone can actually go in, put an anonymous call, and what's nice about the website that we have is we can converse with them and ask them questions, which we couldn't do before, so that we can kind of ask some further questions. They can log back in with their passcode and see the status of the investigation as it's going along. So it's been a great change, and I think, you know, we're hoping to get a lot more advertising out there so we can have people calling.
I assume that's this.
That's it. That's right.
Thank you. We'll continue on. Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, just our last audit area is our information technology audits. Those are ones, and I maybe like to talk to them in two different buckets. There's a portion of what we do in this area that is required by audit standards. We are attesting to the numbers in financial statements and the numbers that come out of systems. And so in order to do that, we need to apply the audit standards that require us to do certain testing of system controls in order to come to that conclusion.
Let's talk a little bit, though, about your level of expertise to do that. In conversations with DAS and realizing the increasing complexity of our state systems, and now with the possible development of the CNIC, the Consolidated Network Information, whatever it is, the expertise required to do these complex technology audits, and I'm sorry Mr. Rollinger left because I'm trying to figure out how, in what we heard this morning, the technology piece fits into this.
Going back to that, Madam Chair, I'll handle the expertise piece of that. On our staff, we have a number of certified information systems auditors, which need to go through both a testing and a licensing process to get there. Our manager in charge of this section is also a certified information systems security professional. We call it a CCP, but it's an advanced security certification and training that he went through to get there. I guess the piece of the work that we do that supports the other audit work, we are following audit standards, and that's work that we have to do in order to conduct our other audit work.
Is this credential, and you're the manager in that department, the security professional, is that a nationally recognized credential?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is. And if I guess if you take the concept of fiscal accountability and where really our biggest fiscal risks are right now, and I would say that it would lead you almost directly to our information systems. We have a number of providers that send in now electronically payments for payment, and that payment goes out the door without any human intervention at all. And, you know, traditional audit work, when this was done by staff, we would go in and look at those human controls that are over, you know, segregation of duty and the handling of the cash that was coming in and, you know, the checks and balances over the invoices. Well, now with all this being automated, we can't do that same kind of traditional audit work that we do. Auditing is evolving and including in it that review of those information technology system controls, and that's what's critical in order to provide that same level of assurance that payments and things that are coming in and out of the system are done according to, the same kind of controls that we would expect with a manual system.
If Mr. Fleming from the Department of Administrative Services were here, what would he tell us about your systems security professionals' engagement with the development of some of the scenic work?
Madam Chair, I'd hate to guess what his opinions are. I know that we have had many conversations with him about the work that they're doing and the work that we're doing. We see it being a very good link with what they're doing. And I'm going to talk just a second about fiscal controls, and I see us moving in the information technology controls in that same kind of a fashion. The state controller sets the fiscal policy for the state and works with state agencies to ensure that they have sound financial controls. Our office goes in and does an independent assessment to make sure that that system is working, including the oversight and the direction given by the Department of Administrative Services. We see the same kind of role taking place in information technology controls, where Information Resource Management Division is establishing the policy and helping agencies set those controls and making sure that those controls are working, with then an independent look coming in to make sure that the controls are in place and working as intended. It's that independent look is where we
come in. Maybe you've touched on one of the subtleties that had eluded me until just now. With respect to just the manipulation, storage, safekeeping of data, let's assume within the scenic process, Department of Human Services is there, and they're keeping all sorts of data about people.
Right.
That data may not have a fiscal connection. It's just data of users, data of consumers of services, data, whatever.
Right.
No checks, no cash. To what degree are you engaged in anything to do with that system?
Madam Chair, I would say that we would look for those links to some kind of a fiscal tie. And you know, again, maybe I'll go back to one of our most recent information technology audits that just went out on Thursday, was looking at the Department of Human Services client maintenance system. That is a system that many of their various subsystems kind of draw into and pull eligibility information from.
It could trigger a check somewhere down the line.
Right. And, in fact, you know, part of that system also does trigger checks, and we found that there was a little over $300,000 in overpayments with problems in the computer checks and balances that as a part of that particular audit. While we were doing that work, we also had another number of significant security findings, which we issued a confidential separate report that, you know, isn't part of the public report, but that is being used right now by IRMD and DHS as part of this data consolidation. They were very surprised. They thought they had, you know, the firewalls in place where they thought they were working as intended. Wireless security had some issues that they weren't aware of. And so I think that was an important part of it in looking at that key system that drives some of the fiscal actions at the Department of Human Services.
Let me just ask one more question, Mr. Secretary. They have routine meetings as the scenic is coming online. Do any folks from your technology audit shop sit in on those meetings?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. There's a fine line to walk between the creation of systems and controls and then the ability to come back later and independently audit them. If you're a part of the creation of the system, it's hard to then be seen as an independent look when you're going back later to say whether it's working or not if you created that system. We have provided input on, you know, here's what we will look for as far as audits. But, you know, and that's part of our auditing standards, is you need to be independent of the management decisions that go into any kind of a program.
So. Mr. Secretary, I preempted you.
No, you did not. I was not seeking. I was just waving my arms. I hate to have a habit.
Waving your arms in enthusiasm as your staff present. That's noted for the record. Ms. Polino, please continue.
Madam Chair, that's the last functional area that we have. We do have some option packages, and I don't know if this is the time to talk about those at all.
Senator Morris.
Kind of open to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we move on, which line item is the IRMD audit?
Information technology, I have as number, your number 28. Is that right?
28.
It's on the next to the last page.
It says information technology audits.
Okay, that's the RMD. Thank you.
I think my preference is, and I'd be guided by the professional staff, my preference is rather than getting into the policy option package in the absence of our three House colleagues, I think I would prefer to move into any of Mr. McGuire's comments and still stay at this high level and then come back when we have the full complement of the committee to discuss the policy option packages. Any guidance from the professional staff?
Madam Chair and remaining member of the committee, I think the plan was to have folks go into budget detail, but if the audits division is available to come back tomorrow, they weren't scheduled to come back tomorrow, but if they're available to discuss their policy packages, then that would be fine. And if they just want to proceed with high-level overview of the executive office and then address those packages tomorrow as well, that would be fine.
Does that work with your schedule, Ms. Polino?
Fine.
Okay, then that's what we'll do. So we'll soldier on. Mr. McGuire, you're up to bat.
Right. Madam Chair, again, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. I'm going to talk very briefly about the functions of the Executive Office for the Secretary of State. The Executive Office provides the leadership, policy guidance, coordination, and daily management needed to manage the diverse and complex programs that are the Secretary of State's office. The office develops the department's strategic plans and legislative initiatives, handles press relations, and serves as the liaison with foreign, federal, state, local, and tribal officers and the Oregon State Legislature. The office provides the staffing support for the secretary in his role as a member of the state land board. The office fulfills the role of accepting custody of the original laws adopted by the legislature and assigning chapter numbers for those statutes. The office oversees the use of the state seal and responds to thousands of public inquiries about state government. Like the other internal support division, the executive office is funded on a split of general and other funds. This budget request represents the status quo for the executive office. It includes one POP, which reclassifies a position to a public information representative to reflect the activities of the position. That's it. How about that?
That was the soul of brevity.
We're here to serve.
Any question for Mr. McGuire? Fine. Then we will invite Mr. Morgan forward. Mr. McGuire, I think you get the award for highest high-level overview delivered with speed and alacrity. So you, right now you're the standard setter.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Morgan, if you'd identify yourself, please.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Morgan, and I'm the director of the Business Service Division for the Secretary of State. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Business Service Division is one of three internal support divisions for the Secretary. We provide payroll, accounting services, which include payroll, processing of vouchers, accounts receivable, agency transfers, deposits, refunds, and internal auditing. The budget section provides all the budget development and preparation for the agency's budget, expenditure tracking, for budget execution, cash analysis, and financial analysis. The Business and Cash Management Services section, which we recently renamed to try to reflect better what the section does, they receive all the mail, process the mail for the agency. They cashier all the incoming payments, whether it's checks coming in for business renewals to Corporation Division and other services or items bought and paid for. Handle the daily deposit through a deposit interface system of cashiering the funds coming in. They work on Blue Book distribution. They inventory and maintain our fixed asset inventory. They also have our Visa and MasterCard service program and are responsible for the lockbox service program.
And tell us a little bit, what's the lockbox service program?
Yeah, the lockbox is where we have paid people who send for the corporation division for payments for business renewals. They have those renewals go out, and those funds go to a U.S. bank who we're contracted with, and they receive and cashier the money for us. And then finally, the purchasing and contract section, they handle all procurement activity for the agency and all contract administration of the contracts that we have. As the other internal support divisions, we operate on a general fund and other fund split as well.
And just remind us how many folks are in this part of the operation.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have 16 in the business service division. We have one performance measure that we do collectively with the other internal support divisions in the front office, and that's a annual customer services survey where we solicit feedback on the services and quality of services we provide. Also, a measure of performance is meeting monthly with the directors of each division and the executive office to go over any issues with our services. We also go over our monthly spend analysis on the budgets for each division.
Let me stop you. Who all do you consider your customers?
Oh, that's a great question. Our customers are the internal support, all the divisions within the agency. But also, our customers are other state agencies. We work with vendors, contractors that have reason to do business with the Secretary of State.
How about a sample of the public? I know that under Secretary Bradbury, there's been an effort to reach out to the public. Mr. McGuire discussed the number of calls that you field from people asking about functions of state government. In your survey, is there ever any attempt to take a random sampling of the public?
Madam Chair, in our survey, the annual customer survey we do, we have not surveyed the public. Generally, the public that comes into our office, we will sell them a blue book. We might make copies. That's somewhat the extent. And other than directing people down to the corporation division, because they always come into our office first.
How about elections? I'm curious to you're doing a customer survey, and I'm trying to think of all the places where the Secretary of State's office interfaces with the public. And elections quickly jump to my mind because that's the place of, at least unless you disabuse me, that's the place that I think of as the primary interface. I don't think of the Secretary of State's office as a place to go buy the blue book so much as I think of it as all of the election function.
Madam Chair, the Corporation Division, when they're here on Thursday, can talk about the surveys they have done of customers. I think, in fact, for those of us in the building, we may see the Elections Division as interacting with people more than people outside the building would tend to see, because at least for elected officials, you have to deal with the Elections Division more than common citizens.
Oh, I don't know, Mr. McGuire. You show up pretty frequently in my public meetings.
the Corporation Division has literally thousands of customers, and we do a survey. The Corporations Division does a survey of its customers, and when Peter Threlko is here on Thursday, he can talk about our customer satisfaction work.
I think one of the things that you may see coming out of this budgeting process is the insinuation of a customer satisfaction survey in all performance measures. And I think the idea behind this is to get standardized year after year surveys that obviously will have to have some change over time just to keep them fresh, but with the idea to compare customer satisfaction year over year for the benefit of the legislature in some kind of consistent way. And I hope you alert your colleague in the Corporations Division to be able to talk about customer satisfaction.
And Madam Chair, my apologies. I was speaking just from the perspective of business services on the survey, but I do agree customer surveys have a value, and we take them seriously. And we could certainly look at folks outside the contractors that come in to do business with the Secretary and the relationship and how that works. We certainly see a value in that.
Okay.
Very briefly, some of the things we've done to make business a little easier to, in dealing with Secretary of State regarding contract opportunities. We have put up a published a web page that we put up over the past year and a half, so any contractor interested can go out and view opportunities for contracts. They can register, and through that registration, when they add themselves to a list of bidders for a particular solicitation they're interested in, they're automatically noticed by automatic email on any addendums to that RFP, award information, and just they can track the process.
Give us an example.
A great example in the first RFP that we used to test the system live was the centralized voter registration RFP, which was the request for proposal to implement the Help America Vote Act for a centralized voter registration and election management system. This was a great test in that we were dealing with vendors nationally rather than more locally on smaller contracts.
Let me make sure I understand this. Is this for the provision of the voting devices, or is this the provision of the contract that actually put in place the recommendations of Help America Vote?
This is
interfaced with the clerks, had all that.
Yeah. This is for the actual development of the application for the centralized voter registration database that also has an election management module with it. For the
I hear those words. Oh, I don't have a clue what they mean. Mr. Secretary, can you help us?
Madam Chair, one of the things that the Help America Vote Act, the federal law, requires is that every state develop a statewide centralized voter registration
right.
system. Currently in Oregon, we have 36 county registration systems.
Right.
We do not have one central database. So one of the things we have to do under HAVA is develop a statewide centralized voter registration
right.
system, which is a major contract with some computer software, hardware vendor.
Right.
And so that's what Jeff was talking about, was that we had a lot of contract people, a lot of people interested in the contract nationally. It turns out that the contract went to an Oregon firm, which we're very happy with, but there were a lot of competitors nationally.
And
so this internet provision of information was very useful.
And we were, I'm sorry. Yeah. And what we were able to do was this, there was a lot of informational documentation that we were trying to make available as quickly as possible. We could put the documents on our contract website. People could view it and download it immediately. So they were getting information real time. And we were on a very fast track. So there was a real value in.
Senator Morissette.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you get federal funding to help with this? You do.
A lot of funding.
Well, let me rephrase it then. Then we need to do a state match, obviously.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's our part is okay.
Senator Morissette, you'll have the opportunity to revisit that as we move through their policy option packages, and it is a stunning amount of federal money for the state
yes.
match. Please continue.
And I think for the sake of time, I know time is running quickly. We also have added ourselves to one program option package, and that's the POP 161, the Help America Vote Act. This project, the Help America Vote Act we were just talking about, generated a tremendous amount of contracting activity for our office. And Patty asked us if we needed resources to begin with, and we put our heads together and believed that we could deal with the workload as it came. And about a year later, I told Patty I was clueless on what this was bringing with it. We are seeing our permanent contracts officer manages over 100 contracts for the agency. The Help America Vote Act and implementation of that to date has generated around 100 contracts and agreements. And we're seeing another 36 memorandums of understanding that we're working with. So it's a full-time job. And so
these memorandum of understanding and the number 36, I'm assuming, is not entirely coincidental that there are 36 counties and you have an MOU with each county.
Not entirely at all, Madam Chair.
Let me ask a question that maybe you know the answer to, and if not, we'll pose to the elections folks, and that is, as the devices, the voting devices, are procured for the counties, is that going to be a standardized set of devices?
The Madam Chair, we are, in fact, this afternoon having the first meeting of the Accessible Voting Systems RFP Committee, which I chair. And the short answer to your question is that decision has not been made. That will be a decision that is made as part of the procurement process if we are convinced that there is a system that will work with the multiple voting systems that exist in the counties currently, then we will go with one, and there are certainly advantages in going with one accessible voting system. If there is some pressure among the counties to go with multiple systems because not every county is using the same vendor for their current for what they have, and there is some desire to keep continuity of systems.
Mr. McGuire, I'm perplexed about this, and this is something that I just am, I guess, putting you on notice. I want to talk about more. It was my understanding early on that the whole idea of the Help America Vote Act was we'd have centralized voter registration, and perhaps I was wrong in this assumption, we would have a similar method, if not similar devices, for voting in each one of our 36 counties. And what I hear you saying is that there is resistance to changing what exists in some of the counties now, and that we may try to accommodate that resistance by allowing the all-access voting machine to accommodate whatever program, whatever county clerk has in place. Am I missing something here?
Madam Chair, let me take a step backwards.
Let me add one more thing. And if we approve this policy option package, $17 million will come here, and if I understand your financials, you can't spend it all. There's going to be some of it in some kind of a reserve account. And I can't imagine that we're going to end up with a hodgepodge of voting machines throughout 36 counties that would require separate maintenance contracts, separate parts stores, separate... Help me here.
Madam Chair, the Help America Vote Act provided funds for states to replace punch card systems and lever systems. We had no lever systems in the state, so that was a non-issue. Seven counties at the time of the November 2000 election had lever machines. Punch card machines. Four counties replaced those punch card systems between the November 2000 election and the enactment of HAVA. HAVA provided for reimbursement for those expenses back to those four counties.
But they bought whatever they wanted.
They bought whatever they wanted. As long as it was not lever, they can buy anything they want as long as it's not a lever machine or a punch card machine. Three counties have replaced punch cards since the enactment of HAVA and have purchased two systems. I mean, both are optical scan systems. One is manufactured by a company called Election Systems and Software. The other is manufactured by a company called Sequoia. The basic difference is ES&S uses ovals. Fill in the oval. Sequoia does complete the arrow. I mean, for the voter, that's the primary difference.
What's the difference in their maintenance and after-sale support contracts?
Those decisions, Madam Chair, are made at the county level. Those contracts happen at the county level. We do not have legal authority to assume control over that function from the counties. Those are local county decisions. There are 36 separate contracts between counties and vendors for that equipment.
Well, given that we're out of time, I think you can anticipate that we'll want to chat about that a little bit more. Mr. Morgan, how close are you to completing?
I'm just about 30 seconds away.
Take 30 seconds.
Okay. Madam Chair, the last thing really we wanted to mention that Secretary Bradbury alluded to was at the direction of the committee in the Phase 1 hearings, the internal support divisions were asked to look for efficiencies, and the business service division, we have identified $50,000 in cost savings that will come out of our S&S budget that we are offering up as a cost savings.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to end. Thank you for your leadership on helping to do that.
It's a start.
That's a start.
Can I ask just one question?
Senator Morissette.
Are there any states that require uniformity in the new system?
That's
an answer for tomorrow.
Madam Chair, yes.
There are.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Mr. Morgan, thank you for coming forward with some savings rather than having 90 amateurs romping through your budget. Having you and your professional staff offer that up is very useful. And unless there are any additional comments, unless there are any additional comments from the panel or the Secretary's office, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5067, the Secretary of State. We will take up at 8:30 tomorrow morning with the conclusion of Ms. Polino's remarks, and see you then. We stand adjourned.